6, 7, 8, and to go to you to make amends, 5 steps come from the fourth column. That's how important the fourth column is. It's truth you can't get to on your own mind. It's truth that is not in your own mind some of the time. Right? The other thing is something that came to me in the last few years, my last couple inventories. Check this out. Stay in the fourth column until you can rewrite the first two and see that they were lies too. It's easy to see the third column lies. I'm not the greatest boyfriend in the world, and I'm also not a piece of shit, whether it was low self-esteem or high self-esteem. What I wanted was ridiculous. What I thought I needed was insane. How I thought you should see me was absolutely crazy. Okay? But I never saw always that the first two columns are also a lie. So here's an example. I got her name in the first column. And the second column is that she left me. Third column, Mark described. I'm the greatest boyfriend in the world. No one should see Mr. AA being left. I want her to stay no matter what I do. I need her to be okay. Friends don't leave friends. Sex relations, women don't leave men. Real men. Women don't leave real men. Men leave women, right? And nobody leaving me should affect my... I see the lies. I see through the lie. I see the lie. Turn the page over. I start writing. Where was I selfish? Where was I selfish? I did this, and I only cared about this, and this, and this. Put stuff you did, put stuff you didn't do. 3 kinds of dishonesty, outright lies. What's more dishonest, me telling you an outright lie or me not telling you the truth by omission? Just as dishonest. Self-delusion, there's the third kind of dishonesty. One of the biggest lies was I thought I needed her to be okay. The third column, you'll find your dishonesty. Where was I afraid? And all of a sudden, my intuition goes, holy moly, you're not mad at her for leaving you. You're mad at yourself for driving her away. So what I do now is this. I stay in the fourth column until I can rewrite the first two columns. And so far in the last 3 inventories, they've only been toward 2 things. Either me or God. Then when I'm done and I have those at the bottom of every fourth column, what the real first and second column should be, I take those as a new first column, and I got about 10 toward myself. And I take the second one, which is God, and I got about 10 toward myself. And I do 4 columns on those, and that's an inventory. That's the meat and the potatoes of the inventory. That's the kind of awareness that lasts for about 2 days after a fifth step. And you've seen it before you even get to the fifth step. Take those 10 or 20. It's just 10 or 20 more pages of inventory. So here's the key. Stay in the fourth column until you can rewrite the first two. It'll either be toward you or God. Take those 10 or so toward yourself and the 10 or so toward God. Do 4 columns on those. The third column of some of those will blow your mind. One of mine was, shit, I want to drink and not pay any price. The other one was, I want to control God, right? Through meditation and learning. The third and fourth column of those last 10, the rest of the inventory will help you with your amends. This inventory will be the root, because you brought every resentment down to what it was really about, and it wasn't about all 3 columns. The whole front page, column 1, 2, and 3, all lies. Even if the truth about the lies are true, even if the son of a bitch really did do that, you got to see through it and see that it was a lie. Even if the truth about the lie is true. Powerful principle. You can see it. It's possible to see it. Inventory will show you. Inventory written this way is so powerful it can take what you absolutely think up to that moment is absolutely true. If you would have asked me during that inventory, after she left, if you would have asked me the day you saw me, I'm in the first 3 columns. Who are you mad at? And why are you mad? I'm mad at her for leaving me. I will fight that to my death. And all of a sudden in the fourth column I saw, holy moly, it turned the lie into the truth and the truth into a lie. I'm mad at myself for driving her away. And I get to get free. Sad thing is when they tell you the truth will set you free, they never tell you just before it does, it really pisses you off. Right? Stay in the fourth column until you can rewrite the first two. Now about sex. I'm really not the guy to be talking about the sex inventory. Mark is the expert on this one. But I've had some experience, because the sex inventory ain't about sex. It's about subjecting each relationship to this test. It would be a very scary thing to find out that from the theater of the lie, we're going to talk about it in the fifth step, as these personalities slowly start to be smashed through a process of admission. Wouldn't it be really screwed up? And I hate to mess with those of you that have done a lot of work on your relationship in a fit spiritual condition, if you know anything at all about equanimity. There is no such thing as a relationship when you're at one. Some people you're closer to, some people you know better, but there's nothing but love, compassion, truth, understanding. Relationships dissolve when you learn about equanimity. Right? There's no such thing as a relationship. We've seen what happens when you think there's a relationship. You ever gone home when you're in that third column stage, state of mind, and you're with your mother, your father, your sister, your brother, and your wife, and you're in a room and all of a sudden you can't say a word? You know why? You got a different relationship with each one of them, a different role with each one of them, a different belief system with each one of them. But through the fifth step, and those personalities can be smashed, you'll find there's no such thing as a relationship. But we have to examine each relationship to see through the illusion of them. And it asks us to list the relationships. And then it gives you 9 questions. So I pray. The list comes. A woman blew my mind one time at a meeting. I'm in inventory. I've been doing the work for many years. She comes up to me and she says, "You're writing inventory?" I said, "Yep." She said, "Have you gotten to sex inventory yet?" I said, "No. I'm in the fear inventory." She said, "Let me ask you a question. What's the most important relationship in your life?" And I said, "God." She said, "Have you ever answered the 9 questions from the sex inventory about your relationship with God? Try it. It'll fuck you up. You'll see. The inventory will show you what you do with power, grace, and the love of God. What you do with it. Thank God that God ain't like most of the people that we are involved with. Because the people we're involved with, you know what they expect? And it's pretty healthy. She expects time, commitment, devotion, honesty. Boy, if my relationship with God was like my relationship with every woman I've ever been with and every human that I've ever known, I wouldn't be here today. He'd be pissed at me. Look at the time I give him. Look at the commitment. This inventory now is about what I do with power since my last time from 1 through 9. What I do in 10, 11, and 12 when I think I'm clear. Stay away from people in 10, 11, and 12 that know they're hot. You know when I think you're the hottest? The day you finish the last amends, you're conscious. You're untouchable. You're untouchable. Nobody can touch you. But you're open. You're wide. You're awake. Then you slowly start to screw up. That space between 9 and 1. Yeah. Write inventory next time you're in inventory. Answer the 9 questions about what you think is the most important relationship in your life. Right? Answer the 9 questions from the sex inventory about your relationship with yourself. Put you and God on your amends list. Try to make amends to yourself in a mirror. Oh, it sounds simple. It ain't going to be like going to somebody that I ripped off or lied to 15 years sober until I got to doing it. Don Coyas asked me to do it. You know what it was? It was the last one on my list. I couldn't bring myself to sit in front of a mirror in prayer and meditation and make amends to myself for what I'd seen in that 4-column inventory where they all came down to me and God. And then to sit in prayer and meditation, make amends to God, and ask what I can do with this relationship I say that's so important. Right? Those that want to stay for questions, let's take a 15-minute break. Everybody else, I think they're going to start tonight at 7:30. Mark and I'll be... Alcoholic? How about a few questions about step four? As far as I know, they're going to... Is Bart or Rick here in the room?
Food in 20 minutes. Joe, food in 20 minutes.
And they're starting tonight at...
Food in 20 minutes starting tonight at 7:30.
I think they're starting tonight at 7:30 with Mickey and Chris. What else did I want to say? 7:30 tonight? They're starting at 7:30. Okay, let's go ahead. Any questions about step four?
Yeah, I'm in the ninth step. I'm tempted to make amends, but I'm having difficulty with the fourth column of the fourth step, seeing what I've played in my own undoing, and it was suggested to me to go back to the first step.
You're in the ninth step, but you're having trouble seeing the clarity in the fourth step, but you're asked to go back to the first step? Where's your sponsor? Is it Sydney or Loretta? Go to the person and ask them. We always think the most important thing is for us to be clear on what we did. The most important thing is for us to be able to be humble enough to ask them, what did I do that hurt you? Go to the person. Ask them. Tell them why you're there. Ask them what you did that might have hurt them.
But what my major problem I find is getting honest with myself. Coming out of denial about the part I played. The fourth column of the fourth step. The part I played, what I did.
Yeah.
You know, because I still have a tendency of pointing fingers at other people. And I know that it's me, but I have a hard time seeing the part I played.
But you're in amends? And you have the list?
Yep.
And you have their names? Let them tell you.
Do you have some clarity about your part?
Yes.
Your selfishness, dishonesty, fear?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'm feeling now that I have to do this perfectly. And I don't believe it.
Which stage character is saying that? Yeah, well, get rid of that one.
Somebody,
real quick. This is my only comment on perfection. If it's perfect, it's dead.
Oh God! I'm dead.
Two important things we forgot to mention about the sex inventory, and that is the nine questions are on page 96. So if you turn to 96, we'll find the instructions for the sex inventory that our friend Matthew uses. I'm not kidding. Let's go to page 96 for the instructions for the sex inventory. And the instructions say, don't be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You're sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you have to offer. You'll find it a waste of time to keep chasing a man or woman who cannot or will not work with you. Actually, the sex instructions for that inventory, which is about relationships, is on page 69, which is also ironic. And the nine questions are in the middle paragraph. And the nine questions are, we reviewed our conduct over the years past. Make a list. Pray. Let the list come. Add God. Add yourself. The nine questions are, where was I selfish? Where was I dishonest? Where was I inconsiderate? Who did I hurt? Other people around the relationship could have been hurt. I hurt her husband, her brother, mother. Where did you arouse jealousy? Where did you arouse suspicion? Where did you arouse bitterness? Where were you at fault? And what should you have done instead? Keep in mind it doesn't say what could you have done. You probably couldn't have done much better with what you had, but there's a lot you should have done. And question number 9, used as a guide, will help you form a sane and sound ideal for the future. The sex ideal is very important, and it's interesting to me that it's the only part of the inventory that my sponsor ever warned me about not to do unless I wanted to see that area of my life change. but it's a chosen ideal. You ask God to help mold it, and it tells you what will happen if you don't live up to it. Don't try to set one that would be appropriate for a monk, or a saint, or a nun. Make it honest. You want to be monogamous? Make it part of your ideal. You want to have fun and date? Make it part of your ideal. Make it an honest, chosen ideal that you can ask God to show you what's in your heart. Any other questions about inventory? Yeah.
You had mentioned the movie Heat, and you said that they said if you can't let go of something in 30 seconds, it will kill you. How does it apply to the fourth step, and what did you mean by that?
All right. Let me read you something. Every piece of inventory that I have ever written, I have written behind an attachment. So I want to read something to you to give you an awareness of this, see what he's talking about. An attachment is a state of clinging that comes from the false belief that something or someone is necessary for your happiness. Do you have any attachment, people or things that you falsely believe you cannot be happy without? Make a list of them right now before we go on to study how exactly they're going to blind you. And I'll talk more about that, but in essence what he was saying was, is anything you're attached to outside of God in the present moment will lead to great suffering. That's the easiest way to say it. If you go in and look at your inventories, your resentment inventories, I promise you, whatever you've written in whatever name is behind an attachment. Whatever fear you write is behind some attachment. You have fear that you're not going to get it and that you need it. And your sex inventories are normally about attachments. Defined attachment as an emotional state of clinging. I always think of a leech when I think of that. Based on a belief system that I need something or someone in order to be happy and okay. So that's what he meant by that.
That's great. I understand. Every time Mark and I have ever done this and we start to talk about the fourth column as far as getting free, someone always asks the great question. How does a 3-year-old, 4-year-old, 5-year-old, totally innocent, pure child see her or his part in some abusive situation? You don't. But you look at what you did with it for the next 20 or 30 years that was selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, rooted in fear, and how it filtered into every relationship you ever had. And you get free.
And what you're doing with it right now. And the payoff, perhaps.
I've been writing inventory for 20 years on a regular basis, and I've never found a resentment where I didn't see my part, either something I did before the resentment, during the resentment, or after the resentment.
I've seen
I'm
the 3-year-old and the 5-year-old thing, when I did my fourth column on that, I realized when I set aside whatever my parents, what I thought my parents did or the nuns did or whatever, you know, just making what they did irrelevant, I did find that, you know, when I misbehaved, I got punished. You know, I wasn't doing what they asked me to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just if that helps anybody.
Right.
You know, I saw where I was not the daughter I was supposed to be, or the student I was supposed to be. Whatever.
She was saying that when she saw her part with not so much sexual abuse, but with being punished by nuns or parents or teachers or whoever, she did see her part that there was things that she did to break rules that led to...
talks about where were we to blame and our faults. Is that just the same thing? You know,
Now, what did I do?
Yeah,
I was selfish. Mm-hmm. How did I act out on those character defects?
They're great questions to use, but they belong somewhere on there. And a lot of people, something will come up that doesn't exactly fit under selfish or self-seeking or dishonest or afraid, like things they specifically did, fault, or the other one you read. You know, they can be written there somewhere. The fourth column is just about getting to the truth. She's asking another familiar question, that there's recurring resentments that show up on inventory after inventory after inventory. And my bet, which I guess would be a question to you, is I bet that attached to those resentments that keep coming back are unfinished amends. Has been my case. When something shows up, there's an unfinished amends connected to that resentment. Only guessing.
Did you make amends?
No,
actually, the answer is no, I didn't.
Well, sort of, kind of, maybe. How about this one? Have you ever heard this? The only one I owe amends to, the only one I ever hurt was myself. Or how about this one? My sponsor told me to make living amends. Right? I heard a guy say one time, his sponsor told him, go to the top of a big mountain, make amends to the universe, and then he'd be done.
Question.
Hi, I'm
Joanne.
Oh. I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but this happened to me recently, where a fellow AA member, fellow home group member, someone I'm close to, called me not to make amends with me, but to explain to me her resentments.
She said very quickly, I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but if someone in my home group called me to ask me if I had, what was it?
She didn't call to make amends to me about a problem, but she called to explain to me all of her resentments about how I wasn't fulfilling my part of the
problem. Oh, someone called her under the guise of amends and did nothing but explain to her what she had done to
She reviewed her second column of you.
You should have said, thanks for sharing your second column with me. If you ever get a fourth one, call me back. But a lot of I've heard a lot of therapists and probably sponsors that tell people, go back to the people that that you were resentful toward and tell them what they did to hurt you.
Well, that was what they were doing.
Yes, there was a lady there. She's asking, if you get to a name on your list and there's just one resentment, do you use a whole sheet of paper? They're not tablets of gold. Use the whole page and write on that one resentment. Yeah. Joe Blow ripped me off for $500. Third column, turn the page over. Fourth column. No. One piece of paper for each resentment. Column 1, 2, and 3 on the front. Turn the page over. Column 4 on the back. And stay on the back page until the whole front page is bullshit. And then the fourth step has worked, because it's turned what you thought was the truth into a lie, and what you thought was a lie that you had anything to do with it into the truth.
No, talking about the...
No, taking the fourth.
And making the second evaporate.
Right, making the second evaporate. I understand that, but you said basically that, similar to what Mark was talking about, distilling the fears, that all your resentments distill down to either God or yourself.
Yeah.
Which I truly believe. I mean, I can say it's either the hand God dealt me, I was pissed at.
Yep.
Or I wasn't able to play God.
Yep. What's the question?
Well, that's, I kind of really, is that what you meant? Because I was just,
yes. He was saying, in using the principle of staying in the fourth column to until you see the first two columns are a lie, that that's been his experience, that he's either mad at God for not letting him be God or mad at himself for not becoming God. Yeah. And that is similar to distilling down the fears where it ends up with two basic ones. And whatever fears you distill it down by doing four columns on the final ten, like 10 positive ones and their opposites, you'll get down to two fears. They'll change a little bit each time through the work, but what they'll come down to is whether to die an alcoholic death or living on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. That's the bottom line of the fear inventory for me most of the time. Yeah. Aye, lassie. Where are you from? Where are you from? Scotland?
Dublin.
Dublin. Oh, What was the question? I was so caught off in that wonderful accent. I was like that. Is this with one specific resentment or the whole? She's saying if the fourth column isn't clear and you haven't seen your part, is it okay for the person that's hearing your fifth step to help you with it? It's of course. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, the big book says that's life and death. You better have someone sitting across from you who understands that line in the big book, that it's life and death, and the fourth column is a key part of that. Where you're at fault, there'll be no freedom. It's the death of the ego and life of the spirit. So,
sure.
Was it? Wondering, how can someone else see your truth for you? Someone told me that since I'm unable to get honest, I need to pray for God to help me to become honest. How can I see my truth if someone else is pointing it out?
Because they know themselves.
But they don't know.
If it's true for me, it's true for you.
There's only one.
If I have special truth and you have special truth. She was saying, based on her question, how can someone listening to your fifth step help you see the truth? Because they've had their own experience. Is it always going to be true, everything they say? Are they going to know the truth the way God might reveal it? No, it's going to be helpful. It's going to be helpful. That's why the fifth step says we admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another person. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I can't get to the truth in the fourth column if something hasn't happened in 1, 2, and 3 and God reveals it to me through prayer.
And I need someone else. The ego balks upon investigation.
But just because the book says in the middle of the doctor's opinion that we can't differentiate the true from the false doesn't mean that that condition doesn't change when it comes time to see the truth. That'd be like saying everything that's true in the first step is going to be true when I'm in a recovered state. No. I'm given power. In the 11th step, I'm not the same person that started 1. The person that started 1 will drink again. The person that started 1 can't get to the truth in the fourth column. But all of a sudden it was there when I got to the fourth column. The person in the fourth column can't go finish those amends. Mm-hmm. Someone's going to have to interpret that question that can hear her. She asked about destroying an inventory when it's done or comparing it to past inventories. I had a friend one time who died recently, and when I met him in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, 5 years later, I became his sponsor. And when I became his sponsor, he showed me a pile of old inventories that he kept in the house. And I said, go through them and see if there's any names that might help you with a new eight-step list and get rid of those old inventories you're holding on to. Give them to God. But the other extreme is a lot of sponsors will say, burn your inventory before you've gotten what you need out of it as far as an eight-step list. I say, get everything you need out of it to fill out your cards, which we're going to talk about tomorrow, to be clear on your amends, and symbolically in a way that's meaningful to you, give it to God. Get rid of it.
We've only got a couple minutes left.
Chris Alcoholic. Hey, it talks about in the book about we have no opinion on sex. Can you clarify what that means? Like, what is that? You have no opinion.
That isn't what the book says. The big book says we're not the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. That's followed by we all need an overhauling.
We avoid, what does it say? We avoid advice.
Yeah, hysterical thinking or advice.
We let God be the final judge. Counsel with others can be important, but yeah. Use God.
That gives you the freedom to take it anywhere you want to take it.
Huh? What'd you say?
He said that gives him the freedom to take it anywhere he wants to take it.
But it is pretty clear what will happen if your sex conduct continues to hurt other people. And it's also clear of what will happen if you're honest and you've learned your lessons. It actually says, and it shocked me, that God could take me to better things in that area. Yeah. But pimping in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just joking. Just joking. Thirteen step. I set an ideal. When I first started getting asked to speak, I was 3 years sober and my sponsor had me speak at the International in Montreal. It was the first time I spoke outside of Colorado. I made a commitment to myself. He didn't ask me to. I told him my commitment that I would never use this as a way to get laid. And I never got laid at an AA convention. But... In my first sex inventory, I had two women pregnant, one I had been with a few months earlier, one I was currently with. I slept with my first fiancé's sponsee while she was gone to California. The only two times I've read my lover's inventory, the relationship ended within 2 weeks. I don't know if there's a spiritual principle involved in that, but I have a slight idea that I probably would never read anybody's inventory again. And I do happen to remember vaguely that while Mark was in treatment, there was a beautiful woman there that I was helping with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous by taking her to meetings, and we had an affair, and she got pregnant. And I said, why don't you have the baby? She said, that might be a little complicated because my husband had a vasectomy. And the treatment center almost got sued. And ever since then, I've been a saint. I would say that those kind of behaviors did lower the expectations in my sane and sound ideal for the future. When I allowed myself to be human.
What about you, Mark?
Oh, God.
Glenn, we're out of time. We'll cheer on that issue tomorrow. We are out of time.
Thank you.
9 o'clock. 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
And I want to thank Mickey again for sharing and making us laugh today. Laughter is good. We need a lot of laughter. That's the reason that we asked Mickey to come this weekend, because we knew we were going to get serious and then we needed to laugh and enjoy ourselves. And we also asked Chris to come. And as a surprise, we discussed it with him over the weekend, and he agreed. He doesn't say no, and he agreed. I had like a preconceived notion for years of Texans. I hated Texans. Chris, I never told you this, but to me, I thought Texans could just like say "fuck you" really kind, and you didn't even know they were saying it. And when I met Chris was the only person I ever became friends with or really got to know, a Texan. And that's not what he does. He tells you the truth. Nice. He talks to you the way it is. He doesn't hide nothing. And he spoke for us last year at Fellowship of the Spirit. And he got a lot of friends, from what I understand, out of it. Me and him became friends. We trade emails and talk once in a while. And he gets to call me back and talk to four crackheads instead, and looking for me because he got the wrong number. I came to a conclusion this morning when we came back. There was quite a few hundred people here last night, and this morning I noticed a lot of them were gone. And I thought Mark and Joe were very calm. They weren't yelling and screaming. They were just calmly telling the truth. And a lot of people didn't want to hear it and left. Chris, on the other hand, is very passionate. And he tells the truth. And the same thing happens. It doesn't matter how you tell the truth and who you are. God assigns you a role and you play it and you tell the truth. And some people stay and some people go. And Chris has his way of doing it, and makes me laugh. And I love Chris, and I want to thank him again for agreeing to share with us tonight and bring him up. Chris from Hunt, Texas.
Can you hear me all right?
Oh, yeah.
This is so good. My name is Chris Raymer. I'm a recovered alcoholic. And I am honored to be here. Guys, I got to tell you real, because this was an afterthought, me coming up here and doing this. And I'm not going to keep you very long. I'll try to make this about 30 minutes. And I just want to visit with you a few minutes. I got a chance to meet so many of you last year, and I absolutely... I'm like Bart. I never knew anybody from New York, for heaven's sakes. And it's like, I mean, you think y'all got preconceived ideas what Texans are, buddy? I mean, you guys from New York have been taking bad rap for years, And it's like I was up here last year and was just absolutely blown away with your hospitality, and I was a consummate tourist, You look at the Empire State Building and start crying. I mean, what's this shit? I mean, it's like stuff you've grown up with as a school kid, and then all of a sudden you get to see it in person. And then there was the towers and stuff, and what a year y'all have had. And I'm just going to take a few minutes with you. I just want to visit with you for 30 minutes or so and talk about some stuff. I came up Thursday night and talked at my buddy's Mike's group in New Jersey on Thursday night, and got to follow Joe Hawk, eloquent speaker as he is, from India and California, and what a guy. And then I get to come up here and follow Mickey Bush. I mean, this what is this, my turn in the barrel this weekend? What a... I got to come up here one time just do me, and then I don't have to confess. But I got to say this, it's a hoot, because I've shared the podium with Mickey a bunch, and a few years ago, some of y'all that have heard some of my tapes and stuff, I do a lot of talking, Cokehead Anonymous also, and uh, I uh, uh, I guess it was 2000, the World Conference, I got to speak. And, buddy, there was 3,000 people out there in that audience. There was 2,000 in the ballroom and 1,000 under a tent outside. And 500 people during my talk got up and left en masse and pissed off because they didn't like what I was saying from the podium. And it wasn't that they didn't like what I was saying. I think they didn't like the tone I was using. And I think the fact that I called them couch-broke sons of bitches had something to do with but I took a lot of scalding from it, you know, and I'm telling you, and I made amends where I needed to make amends. But, I mean, the truth of the matter is we've got some problems in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we've got some problems in our sister fellowships of Narcotics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous. The problem is that a lot of people aren't getting sober with a message that we should be all getting to hear. We're not hearing. And that's where I was coming from that night. But anyway, when I took so much heat for that nonsense, I got to tell you, it was Mickey Bush. It was right there on my doorstep the next morning telling me how to carry the cat. I mean, you think it's one thing to come up here and share. Somebody says, boy, you must really love this. I've said this from the podium before, and I just need to say it again because I've got so many friends in this audience. I love seeing you guys and hugging your neck and being a part of your lives. I hate to speak from the podium because I can't seem to quite get it right. Because when I talk, I mean, my intention is every time I come speak, I want to come up here and tell you a few stories, entertain you a little bit, talk to you about my recovery, and then leave. But, you know, it's like I get into this thing about 10 seconds, and God kind of kicks in, and it's like, and I start talking. I'm a product of a fellowship that nearly killed me, trying to help me get comfortable in this fellowship. They forgot to tell me how to stay sober. It's just exactly what Mickey was saying. It's like we were so busy with the chicken shit one-liners that we couldn't get down to what the message was about. This message is about having a spiritual experience and getting connected to God. And we're too busy trying to water it down and make it palatable for everybody to get comfortable at. But I nearly died of a fatal illness. And so I come up here and I try to talk to you cats about this, and I want y'all to see where I'm coming from. I'm going to get fucking whiplash from doing this tonight. It's like, could we have done this? Could we have done this any different? It's bad enough with one fucking eye in here, you know, and it's like, God damn. Mickey, you watch that side of the room for me, okay? And I'll watch this side of the room right. I'm just another story. I know, really. I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12-step meetings. I love Cocaine Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous. Guys, it's the only game in town. I talk a bunch of I do clerical work for a treatment center, so I get to see that into the perspective. I get a lot of people want to come talk to me. I made a lot of friends with y'all last year because I'd worked in the industry and we stayed connected. And in fact, the truth of the matter is this, that there's a lot of good things come out of treatment centers. There's a lot of great therapy and a lot of cool stuff happening out there. But our success rates suck, you see? And our success rates should be better if we could get that. See, what happens to us is that we send people out of our treatment centers and we send them back into a fellowship. Now, if we're lucky enough to send them into some of the groups like you guys go to, where they're actually carrying big books and doing the work, these cats stay sober the rest of their lives. They have great lives. But if we send them to meetings where all they want to do is sit around and piss and moan about their problems, they don't stay sober. And see, that's my job. I do the clerical work. If we get 1,000 people through this hospital that I work a year, and my department, there's 4 of us, and that's all we do all day long is call these cats, hey, hey, you still sober? Buddy, lay the crack pipe down. Talk to me just for a few minutes. Let's wrap. Let's visit just a little bit. What happened? You know, and it's like, it's the same story. For 9 years I've been hearing this. Now, guys, you can get twisted about this if you want to. I mean, this is my nickel. I'm up here for free. You know, no, nobody's twisting my arms. You just need to hear this. If it wasn't the truth, I wouldn't be risking my friendship with you to tell you about this. The people are not staying in the fellowship because the fellowship is unfucking palatable. Well, we need to. It's the truth. We can't keep the young adults in the meetings because there's too many people telling war stories that they can't identify with. We can't keep the women, the professionals in the fellowship because there's too many people using it as a process group. Alcoholics Anonymous is not now nor ever was a process group. This is what scalded them in Phoenix, because everybody thinks that what I do from the podium is that I make fun of therapy. And that's the last thing I want to do. But there's two separate things. I'm a product of some great therapy. I went through a little this time last year when I was here. I was married, and I'm not married today. Buddy, don't you think I went through some therapy around that? You know what I didn't do and I made a point not to do? was walk back into your recovery meetings and spilling my guts about that cheap shit. Because it had nothing to do with you staying sober. Ain't that right? I just said it. It's the most controversial thing I'll say from the podium, and I'm going to try to go through this real quick. But I got to say point blank. It's really disrespectful, I think, when we go into meetings and just dump shit on the table and expect the room to clean it up. And it's like, I wish I could remember her name, and I don't, what's your name?
Michelle.
And we were talking earlier, and we were talking about this business, about this in the meeting. Is that the problem is that not that any of us want to be abrasive or abusive, it's that we all have a tendency to want to walk on eggshells and be very gentle with the newcomer because we don't want to piss anybody off. But you know, at what point, I said it last year, and I've said it 1,000 times, there's a little article in Box 459 years ago, and this lady in this thing said, at what point does live and let live become apathy? I'm so concerned about hurting your feelings that I'm just going to shut up and let you ruin the whole meeting for everybody talking about your horse shit. See? I'm an alcoholic, folks. I'm just like Mickey and Mark and the cats and so many of y'all I know in this room. I'm an alcoholic and possibly have some problems with cocaine. I don't know. I just know I bankrupted 2 businesses around the cocaine, but I don't know if that had anything to do with me having a problem with it or not. But I'm doing this because I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. Now, folks, here's the key piece, and I think so many people don't understand. I think Joe and Mark have done a great job this weekend trying to explain this to you cats. Alcoholism and drug addiction is not causal. Can y'all get your little hands around that? Alcoholism and drug addiction is not causal. Nothing out there is causing me to be alcoholic and addict. If that is, then what I need to do is do like we do in treatment a lot of times, is treat that problem, and then you can get the fuck out of here and go have a great life. See? Please, by all means, and don't let the door hit you on the butt on the way out. Because if you don't need to be here, we don't want you here. Alcoholics Anonymous is for alcoholics or people who suffer from a disease called alcoholism. You know, I don't know why this scalds people. I don't know why this offends some cat. Everybody in the place is welcome in my meeting. Y'all understand that? If you think you got a problem, you come to my meeting. But I'm going to tell the newcomer in here, please, just like I do every time I speak from the podium, you better be real careful who you're listening to in these meetings. Because if you happen to be listening to some little disco drunk out there, I can promise you, some little cat that's going through a little bad spell and he's drinking a little bit too much, you know, and he's in the meeting, he's the one that gravitates to the little chicken shit one-liners. Because his life don't depend on working with others. His life doesn't depend on nothing except coming to a few meetings and everything's going to be okay. And they get through the little rough patch and everything's fine. And I've been sober 15 years thanks to the grace of God and the fellowship of this program. And everything's wonderful. But I ain't ever done one of them goddamn 4 steps. And the little guy in the back goes, check. You think he doesn't? Little guy in the back doesn't know any difference. See, it's just like Mark was talking about today. This fellowship is absolutely chock full of hard drinkers and hard druggers. And that's why, this is why one of the nice ladies this morning that was questioning this thing about choice, we sat back there and said, boys, this lady got courage asking that question. And see, that's what treatment centers are supposed to do, is try to explain to the newcomers, explain to the patient that's in there what the truth is. But I got to tell you, I work for a treatment center right now, and there's a lot of people that work there as employees that don't understand that fine line. They believe that what happens is, as long as I've got alcohol, here's alcohol, and I put it in my body, and I lose control, and I drink too goddamn much. No kidding. Got that. Everybody understands that. But this thing about choice, folks, is just absolutely unbelievable. When I don't have any alcohol or drugs in my body, why is it that I keep going back to it? You see, I drink, the book says, for the effect produced by the chemical. Ain't that right? I don't drink for the taste. I don't drink for the, I mean, we're laughing about it. We go into the crack house. Well, I just like the ambience of the place. You know, I just, something about those mattresses just tossed around willy-nilly. It just feels so right, you know, and I just like, wait, what the fuck? No, I've said it a million times from the podium. Listen, guys, I like Coca-Cola too, but I've never sat down and drank a 12-pack of Coca-Cola. Never, not once. I drink beer because I like the way it makes me feel. I don't like the way it tastes necessarily, especially when it's hot, you know, but I don't care. Come on, guys. How many of you guys ever, at the end of a party, ran out of beer and took a bunch of beer and poured it through a pair of pantyhose and got it in a deal like this and poured it in there? Come on. I want a show of hands of people that have done that. Unbelievable. I've done it. And listen, if the pantyhose are just the... Never mind. I don't. I'm sorry. We're not drinking for the taste. How many cigarette butts do you think got put out in that car? It doesn't make any damn bit of difference. You drink it, it'll still get you loaded. You follow me? I'm drinking because I like the way it makes me feel. Once that stuff hits my system, I don't give a rat's butt. Okay, now then. When alcohol and drugs work, guys, we would laugh about this. I wish I had a little marker if we could mark it. We hit this little target. It's like I had this combination early on, a bottle of Boone's Farm apple wine, a quart of beer, and a little cocaine, and I'll get to a place, you can't touch me. I'll get to a, we were talking about today. Buddy, I can dance with that. You know what I'm saying? And I can't dance for shit. But you get the Boone's Farm, a quart of beer, okay. And then we get to this place, guys, as this progresses, this disease, where this stuff stops working. And now I'm going to jockey a little bit. Now I've got to add a Quaalude to it. Now I've got to add a little more cocaine to it. Now I've got a little. But here's the deal. When alcohol and drugs work, guys, it works great, and it treats that spiritual malady, and it makes us okay. And what so many people out there don't understand, because we're not doing a very damn good job explaining it in our meetings is, you hear me? What we're not explaining to the newcomer is we're not doing this about partying down. There was a point we were all partying, having a good time, Mick. And then there came a time when, God damn it, I'm just drinking to... All I want to do is get enough courage to go buy some bologna so I don't starve to death. Y'all understand that? I'd like to go to the laundromat, wash my clothes. I'm so uncomfortable in my own skin, I can't stand it, so I pick up a six-pack. Can y'all get down with that? I mean, the nice little housewife, she didn't open a wine cooler while she's fixing the kid's cereal because she was thirsty or wanted to just put a new bent on the morning. She's just trying to keep things level so she can take care of her babies the best way she knows how. Alcohol, you see, is the solution to an alcoholic. The drugs are a solution to a drug addict. It's not the problem. And when the shit's working, it ain't the problem. It's great. And then the stuff stops working, and we begin, because of the phenomenon of craving, lose control, and we end up drinking a little bit more. If I could drink a quart of beer and a quart of Boone's Farm deal and get the same results every time, then that's what I would do. But why is it that I would drink it and then end up drinking just a little bit too much? And then, can y'all get down with this? And sometimes I'm right at the right spot, and then the girl's over there, and I'm fixing to go do it. And it's like, ticket, make patch, crate, everything's cool like this. And be walking over there because I'm going to make a little, y'all know what I'm talking about. I'm fixing to go make a little time, you know? And we're going to go make a little smoochy, and everything's okay. And I'm walking over there, and from the time it takes me to get back to my sister back there, it's like I've overshot the mark just a bit. And I get up there like this, and I'm going, holy shit, and I'm slurring my words a little bit. Patch is a little crooked, you know, and I'm looking a little stupid. And I ain't going to get nothing tonight. You follow what I'm saying? And I said, God damn, Chris, you just overshot the mark. Just don't drink so much next time. Because, I mean, it got away. I'm in this, what we call the uncool zone at that point. I'm not enjoying being sick. I'm not enjoying looking like an idiot. I didn't intend to get like that, but I got like that. And I'm never going to do it again, because tomorrow night when I try this again, I'm just going to drink a couple of beers and everything's okay. And by God, I do it again and again and again. And then I get to that place where I go to the outer edge of this target, and I'm in the real, we call it, you know, it's the cool zone in the middle, and then it's the uncool zone here, and it's the real unfucking cool zone out here, you know? And this is where, I mean, we're just off the pay, and we're out here. This is where you get DWIs and fights with a girlfriend, you know, and you get your ass canned, and you pass out asleep in the toll booth, you know, just. The guy's knocking on the goddamn window, you know, and it's like, oh, I just taking a little nap, you know. Guys, that's not cool. That's not cool. That's not cool. And the shit's got out of hand, and now you want to stop. How many of you guys ever did it? How many of you guys ever made a commitment, I'm going to stop? I've done it. And everybody in the place, I hear them at the hospital where I work all the time, well, you just didn't want it bad enough. Let me tell you something. What Mickey said was the truth. I reached a point when life, as I understood it, was unacceptable. And I, by God, wanted to stop. I couldn't. Let me tell you, and this is the can of worms I want to open up. I got 20 more minutes with you. This is a can of worms I want to open up. I'll try to open it and close it in 20 minutes. I know, really. I'll do it. How much money you got on you? I'll do it, by God. All right. No, but here. And so here's what happened. I want to quit, but can't. And so I start going to therapy and treatment and detox it. Y'all follow what I'm saying? And I start getting involved in a lot of this business. And every single therapist I was ever at, and every treatment center I was ever associated with, and every counselor I sat across from, and every doctor I did, said one thing to me. Chris Raymer, you know what your problem is? You're suffering from, I can't hardly say it, low self-esteem. And that's why you drink. I got counselors in the treatment center that I work right now killing alcoholics with positive affirmations. If there's a counselor in here and you're offended by that, come up after this meeting and let me make a personal apology to you. I'm just here to say point blank right now, if you think for a second you're helping me with my alcoholism and drug addiction by telling me to stand in front of a mirror and lie to myself, you are full of shit as the next person. I am a good boy. I'm a happy child of God. I am a good boy. Guys, it's just like we've said it. We've laughed from the podium 1,000 times. It's like me standing in front of a mirror and say, I do have a big dick. I do have a big dick. I do have a big dick. I don't, and it's not gonna change a damn thing. It's nuts. But yeah, we're gonna pay. Listen here. There was a great article written by this lady, Lauren Slater, and I hope I meet her. She's from New York. This was a fascinating article. I can get any of you guys want. You got my number, and I'll send you a copy of this article because it's the best. I'll give it to Bill, and he can send it to everybody on God's creation. Even people that don't want it will get it, I can promise you that. But here's what we've got this in this treatment industry, in this field. Now, I'm a part of the treatment industry, so I'm going to tell you, I'll talk about it. I'll take their inventory. Guys, if they were doing such a great job, we were talking about the other night, why are they closing down every day? In 1993, there was over 600 closed down in 1 year. Why? Because they're not working. Because we're treating it like it's a cause and effect. You're drinking because you got a bad marriage. Get the marriage straightened out and everything will be okay. But that's not the truth, is it? Because guys, we do it all the time. How many of you guys drank and drug when you was in a great marriage? How many when you was in a shitty marriage? How many when you had a lot of money? How many when you had no money? We do it all the time. It doesn't make any difference. I got two guys right here. They're standing right here, right? And one of them's is a millionaire, and he's got a good-looking girlfriend, and he's just handsome. And this ugly slob right here ain't got a pot to piss in, and he's got nothing going for him, and he's basically a loser. But they both got diarrhea. You follow me? And somebody wants to come up and say, you got diarrhea because you make too much money. Is any going to buy that weak shit? But yet we'll take our professionals who are alcoholics and say that they're alcoholic, they're drinking too much because of the profession they're in. That is absolute horse shit. I don't know how we can be any clearer about this. Absolute horse shit. You're drinking because of Vietnam. You're drinking because of the molestation. You're drinking because you're black. You're drinking because you're white. You're drinking because you're gay. You're drinking. If you are, go find a good therapist, work through it, and get the hell out of here. This is the truth. Do you have a disease? Alcoholism and drug addiction is genetic, folks. It's genetic. And it doesn't make a damn bit of difference what you've been through. Do those things affect you? Yes. Do they need attention? Absolutely. Absolutely. Good therapy is the best. But guys, I'm a product of great therapy. I did therapy for 10 years. Every single year I was doing therapy. Did it stop me from drinking? Not a bit. We're trying to treat a disease that can't be treated by human aid. The book says it in the ABCs, doesn't it? That no human power could relieve what's wrong with me. But we're going to try it, aren't we? We try it in therapy. We try it in treatment. And then we come into the meetings and we try it in here. What is a meeting? Human power. If you're using the meetings as a dumping ground for your shit, I'll say it again. I may say it again before I close. Shut up. Stop it. Quit. Don't do it. If you got to do it, at least make sure I'm not in the room. Let me cut to the chase here. This lady's article was so good. Basically, the article is that self-esteem is overrated and suggests that it may be the culprit, not the cure. We've been spending all this time and money trying to build people up by giving them these positive affirmations even when they don't deserve it. You're a great child of God and you're a wonderful person. No, you're not. You're a piece of shit. You've stolen all your life. You've hurt everybody that comes in contact. Come on, guys. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous did for me. It allowed me to grow up and become a man finally. And I got to tell you, at 35 years old, it was a bitch to finally realize that I was not the most wholesome person in the world. Here. Don't start it. Let me see if I can find this little piece here. You got to read this article because she gets in there and cuts to the chase. The problem is, he says, perhaps these researchers are saying pride really is dangerous and too few of us know how to be humble. Humility is what we need in this program, isn't it? Isn't that what it says? But we're going to build you up. See, this humility is the last thing we're going to get. But that it most likely not to, see, the entire reason for ignoring the flaws. Look, sometimes self-esteem can be as bad as your health, bad for your health. There is always market forces and are formable. The psychotherapy industry, for instance, would take a huge hit on self-esteem if self-esteem were to be reexamined. After all, psychology and psychiatry are predicated on the notion of the self and its enhancement is the primary purpose of treatment. You follow me? That's why you go to treat. Look, here's the next line. It's not by means of saying that mental health professionals are trying to screw you around here. I'm paraphrasing. But it's saying really, who could come to treatment to be taken down a notch? How would we get our clients to pay for it if not be insulted, see, at least uncomfortably challenged? There's a profound tension here between the psychotherapy and the business that needs to retain its customers. Mental health is not necessarily a comfortable thing. You follow what I'm saying? Guys, you don't think you're a worthless piece of shit. You think you're king of the universe already. But Mark Houston was talking about it today from the podium. We're king baby. I'm pissed because the world is not doing it the way. I'm driving to the deal this morning with Patty, and Patty's not talking to me the way I think Patty should talk to me. The bitch. Now, we've had a conversation about this, but I mean, we had to walk out here and then get straight with this business because, I mean, you know, you don't know who I am, you know? And it's like, that's right, Chris. You don't know who you are. You know, you're a simple child of God trying to get through the day just like every other schmuck in this room. We're just trying to get through the day. I know better or know worse than anybody else in this room. Makes sense? But the problem with our industry is what we want to do is we want to focus in on everything. If you've got something going on in your life, let's focus in on it. Let's turn it in. And what happens is we become a room full of ingrown hairs. Everybody is just, we're all just this, no, I've sat down. I've sat down with dozens of people, you know, and people not in here, but I mean out there where I work, and they want to talk about the same shit all the time. Oh, geez, this divorce is killing me. I said, goddamn, honey, we were talking about that last month. We were talking about that last year. We were talking about, you're still, you follow me? At what point are we going to move on? Not making light of it. Things take time. But at what point are we going to move on? And the industry, the treatment center industry, I'm going to tell you something, folks. What Mickey was touching on was the absolute truth. By God, we got to get straight. There's an industry out there that wants to keep most of you cats in this room sick. We want to keep you sick. Powerless. Always recovering. You follow me? Because once you recover and realize that you have power, guess whose little ass ain't going to be back in treatment again? Mine. Can you dig with this? Can you get down with what I'm saying? They've got this great little therapy they use in Japan, and I can't pronounce it. Morita. Basically, what it is this extreme form of self-awareness is a bad thing. And so what we do in this therapy is that we grow petunias. And the lady's saying it'd be tough to get somebody to pay $75 an hour to come grow fucking petunias, you know? But the bottom line is you spend an hour out there in nature making something grow, getting out of yourself, thinking about something else instead of your own stuff, and you benefit from that. Make sense? What did Bill Wilson say in Chapter 7 of the Big Book? Working with others. Nothing will so much ensure immunity from taking a drink as intensive work with somebody else. You feel like shit? Go to the group and talk about it. No, don't! That's not what the book says. The book says just the opposite. You feel like shit? Go find somebody else that feels shittier.
That's right.
and help them, absolutely. Do what you can do. Here, let me get, I'm going to read you three or four paragraphs. I'll let you out. I'm going to do this on time, too. This will be good shit. Listen, this is a little book I sent to some of y'all before. It's a little book written by a cat here in New York, and another one I'd like to meet. I'm going to come back up and visit. This cat's name was Mitchell Kay, and he wrote this little book called How It Worked. It's the story of Clarence Snyder, and Clarence gets a bad rap in AA today. I mean, everybody wants to, he's dead anyway, but what the hell? Anyway, I guess he got what he deserved. I don't know what. But he died sober, and I got to tell you, and he was a pistol. See, we had two groups of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. We had the cats from New York with Bill Wilson, and then with Dr. Bob Katz and Clarence and all the cats. Now, most of the people that were in recovery, that were staying recovered, were around Akron and Cleveland in the Midwest. And you cats in New York were having a little trouble staying sober because Bill Wilson had you doing it one fucking day at a time. Dig what I'm saying? And it was like he was into this therapy business. He loved this shit. He liked to get in and talk about his belly button and things. You know, I mean, history books are full of this. Okay. Okay, but here's the story. This is good stuff. There's a little skinny guy scared of everything. This is Clarence is talking about this cat named Arch. And Arch is in the big book. Said of Arch, Arch had spent weeks and weeks at Doc's. He's talking about Dr. Bob's house. He was being babysat. Y'all understand? Y'all ever do that with a newcomer? Babysit him, take him to your house and watch over him? That's what he was doing, okay? But they'd taken this a little to the extremes. He had been He wasn't drinking, but his mental and spiritual condition wasn't improving either. He was in a strange city and even stranger people. He had already been at the Smith's house, Dr. Bob's house, for 5 months. And he was afraid to leave his room. Now, how many of you guys know people in your group right now that are just like this? They've been around, they're staying dry, quote unquote, but they're not getting any better. They're not getting any better. And everybody wants to stay away from them because they're fucking weird. Yeah, okay. Arch and Ann were sitting and talking, so Clarence and Edna sat for a while and spoke with him. Clarence was trying to stall for the inevitable when Edna kept insisting that the time was time to leave and start back to Cleveland. Clarence came up with what he thought was a brilliant idea. He told Arch that all the rummies in Cleveland were driving him crazy. Clarence said, "I'm so busy I want you to come with me to Cleveland to help me." He told Arch this, "Come back to Cleveland to help me." It says, it was in the back of his mind, Clarence felt he should take someone along for the ride for protection. I mean, nobody wanted to be with this Archie guy. Archie looked at me like he was hit with a club. And Clarence, nobody ever asked Archie to do anything because they felt he was absolutely worthless and useless to society. How many of y'all have done that in the meeting? Oh, don't say anything to them. They're a little sensitive right now. They're going through a bad time. So everybody fucking avoids them. Make sense? Ann, however, thought it was a great idea. No shit. Ann wanted him out of the house, okay? Anything that would help Arch get out of the room was brilliant, she told Arch. He said, "You heard, Harris. Go with him. Run upstairs and get your sweater. You're going with him." Okay, Arch was dumbfounded. He says he nervously looked back at Ann and then to Clarence and back again at Ann. I could just see him. Ann says, "Get." He says, he ran upstairs. He's got his sweater and he went back down. Arch reluctantly got in the back seat with Edna. He relaxed as they drove back to Cleveland. Edna was off his back. Dig, he got back and they took him to Cleveland. One more paragraph. The next day, Arch seemed somewhat different. Maybe it was the fear that Clarence would force him to suffer another long ride with Edna. Or maybe it was something else a little more profound. Arch got so busy with AA in Cleveland that he appeared to change right before Clarence's eyes. Arch went to hospitals and dryout places, helping drunks all over the place. He got so busy and so far over his head, he forgot all about his fears and phobias. Surprisingly, he became a big asset to Clarence and became one of the boys. He eventually went back to Akron, a new man. Within a few months, he returned to Grosse Pointe and started the first AA meeting in Detroit. The forest. Because the people stopped walking around on eggshells with him and started accepting him for what he was. An alcoholic who needed the same solution as me, the same solution as Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob in the first 100. They needed to get off their ass, get out of themselves, and help somebody else have a better day. They needed to get into service. Jesus, guys, bless every one of you in here. we need to look around at our meetings. What we have done, we talked about it last year, and I got to tell you, I traveled a lot this last year. I was in Canada again, in Mexico, and I've been out to Phoenix a bunch. And I mean, I just sick of travel. Every place I go, it's the same thing. We got areas of people just like you who are lathered up and ready to go do this, and I'm preaching to the choir in here with a bunch of you people because you understand exactly what I'm saying. But out there in the real world, there's so many couch-broke sons of bitches that don't understand what's in this literature. And what they believe is that Alcoholics Anonymous is some form of extended therapy for us. It is not. The book says, quote-unquote, we're a fellowship of men and women in action. Not sitting on our ass talking. A fellowship of men and women in action, shoulder to shoulder, carrying one message of hope to the newcomer. That's the 12 steps. That's what we're supposed to be doing. And I said it the other night in New Jersey. I got to say it now. We need every person in here in that trench. The fucking excuses that I get to listen to out there on the road and in my own home group for why people can't pick up their tool and help us work blows me away. It always seems to be about the first step. Maybe you don't think, as we were talking today, that not making those amends has anything to do with whether or not you're going to take a drink or not. It's the same breath. Maybe you don't think getting up off your ass and helping a newcomer doesn't have anything to do with whether you're going to take a drink. You're coming apart at the seams, and you're sitting in a meeting, and you're sitting there with a regular member talking about your fucking divorce one more time, and a newcomer comes to the door and look around, and you dust them because you're way too busy to go help them. Excuse me? Excuse me? Do you want some power to get past that divorce? Then do what the book said. Go help that newcomer. Go help that new. Listen, my experience was quite abundantly clear. In 1987, I walked in with all of the stuff we've talked about today going on in my life. The spiritual malady was choking me to death. I'm taking 7 fucking pills a day just to get through the day. Antidepressants by the handfuls, anti-anxiety, anti-this, anti-that. Pills to bring me up to even playing field so that I could just get through the day. Y'all understand that? And now I'm trying to stay sober. And I'm in these meetings, and the guys got hold of me and said, buddy, you need to come help us carry the message. You're not going to sit in these meetings and use them as a fucking dumping ground for your problem. We're not here as your fucking therapist. When that phone rings next time, don't sit there and look at the person next to you and wait for somebody to answer it. Are you a member of this group? Do you belong in AA? Are you a member? Yes. Then answer it. Well, I don't know what to say. Learn. Be a part. Well, shit. No, guys, the thing phone rings. Everybody stood just like that. Fine. Look, Louisville group. God, I can't do this. This is fucking bullshit here. I don't know what to say to this. Just talk to the lady. She wanted it was an Al-Anon. She wanted a meeting schedule. I said, she wants a meeting schedule. It's right there on the wall. Oh, yep. Nope. Tonight. 7 o'clock, that's your meeting. Oh, and if you can't make it, there's one tomorrow at 6 o'clock. You're welcome. Click. They all just had a good laugh. Very good. Well done, Christy. Well done. They all got their coffee and went back. But let me tell you what happened to me. Not 6 months later, that night, please hear me. That night, I walked back into my club, in my group, poured myself a cup of coffee, and sat down in my meeting. Because for the first time, I was doing something. I've been a taker all my life. And now it's time to start giving back. And you think answering a phone had anything to do with it? You damn right. You think cleaning the tables have anything to do? You bet. Making a coffee? You bet. Everybody thinks you got to speak from the podium or do it. Guys, this is not my 12-step work. This is what I get to do for free and for fun because God's grace allowed me to come on this earth and do it. Come on, guys. What I do in my group is make coffee, clean toilets, help them pay the bills, help them with their finances because I seem to be pretty good at that right now. I didn't used to be. Thanks to God, I am today. Y'all follow what I'm saying? You get a little job in AA and you'll stay. But you don't get the job in AA, you won't stay. And that's why I'm saying, don't just tell the newcomer to keep coming back. I agree with Mick. You need to keep doing that. But by God, you've got to help them a little bit more, feel a little bit part. Get them a job. What's your job? Are you a greeter? Make a commitment. I talk to Patty about it all the time. You know, Jesus, guys, there's some of us in this room, and y'all know exactly what I'm talking about. We got commitments damn near every night of the week. We've got commitments. I'm going to tell you, folks, I understand burnout. I understand not having time to be home with the family and doing the cool things that we want to do. So let's spread the wealth a little bit. What about the newcomer taking a commitment? What about the old coot that's been around the meeting for eight years and hadn't done a goddamn thing except sit in the back of the room? What about him taking a commitment? Everybody wants to defer to the newcomer at times, but I'm saying it's everybody's job. Yes? Guys, I got to tell you, my mama asked me the other day, she says, Chris, you and your brother, you just seem so busy in the fellowship. Every time I turn around, you're going to here and traveling there and going to this. And